Okay, good morning, everyone. My name is Linda Unger, and I'm a writer with the General Board of Global Ministries. I'm happy this morning to be able to introduce you to our panel that will be talking about humanitarian and faith-based organizations linking arms to protect vulnerable women and children. As you know, doing good in the world takes goodwill and strong partnerships. Faith-based organizations are working together with international humanitarian and development institutions to promote a world where the rights of all, especially the most vulnerable, are respected and promoted. Last fall, UNICEF and the World Council of Churches signed a global partnership to protect children's rights. And also last fall, the Global Health Program of the United Methodist Board of Global Ministries committed substantial resources to the United Nations Every Woman, Every Child movement, and that will be over the next 4 years. The UN movement addresses major health issues of women and children around the world. So in this workshop, representatives from UNICEF, World Council of Churches, and the UMC's Global Health Program will share these kinds of collaborations to promote health, safety, and well-being of children and women. And hopefully this will also give you some thoughts and some ideas about why this might be important for you to cover and how you might go about covering this kind of information. Before we get started, I'd just like to introduce our panel. We have Caterina Tino to my left, who works as the Partnership Specialist for UNICEF Civil Society Partnerships in New York since 2011. In this capacity, she works to strengthen, expand, and monitor UNICEF work with religious communities to promote and protect children's rights. In particular, she manages UNICEF global partnerships with SCOLAS, the World Council of Churches, and Religions for Peace. Prior to her appointment with UNICEF, Ms. Tino served as civil affairs officer in the United Nations peacekeeping mission in Kosovo and as researcher at the mediation support unit of the UN Department of Political Affairs, as advisor on disarmament and international security at the Spanish mission to the UN during Spain's EU presidency, and as the UN representative of the International Action Network on Small Arms. Next to Caterina, we have Klaus Gruhe, who is a senior communications professional with extensive experience in leading positions in both the public and private sectors. As a longtime advocate of communicative leadership, he has supported and trained managers and executives in all aspects of strategic communications for a number of years. His background includes middle management positions at Scandinavian Airlines and Falck G4S, a global integrated security company, as well as experience in journalism and public relations. Currently, Klaus serves as communications consultant at the World Council of Churches in Geneva. Following a 9-year assignment as communications director of the Diocese of Lund, Church of Sweden. Since 2012, he is also the regional coordinator in Sweden for the European Association of Communications Directors. And next to Klaus, we have Dr. Olusimbo Ige. She is the executive director of the Global Health Program of the General Board of Global Ministries of the United Methodist Church. She provides strategic leadership, technical guidance, and implementation support to health programs in 25 countries. Her experience spans over 11 years of health services, delivery, health programs management at national and international levels, and health research, also teaching graduate students and doing nonprofit program management consultancies for the World Health Organization, DFID of the United Kingdom, and USAID health programs. Her expertise is in designing and supporting the implementation of strategies to improve health systems from the community up. She is a public health physician, a fellow of the West African College of Physicians in Community Medicine. She has a Master's of Science in Epidemiology and a Master's of Public Health in Global Health Leadership. So as we move forward today, I just wanted to recall to you that in our opening panel, we heard from a number of experts in different fields. Catherine Marshall was among them, and she reminded us of some of the challenges of that collaboration between religious organizations and secular institutions in the field of development. One of the areas where those collaborations seem to move forward is the area of health. So today we're going to hear a little bit more in detail about those kinds of collaborations. We'll have some input from each of our panelists, beginning with Katerina. And then after all three have presented, we'll open the floor for questions. All right, so without any more ado, present Katerina Tino of UNICEF.
Good morning. Can you hear me well? It's a real pleasure for me to be representing UNICEF here today with you. Given that the impact of religion starts right from childhood, the critical role that religious communities can play in promoting the well-being of children has long been recognized by UNICEF. We have countless examples from the eradication of polio in India to the more recently the key role that religious leaders played in the fight against the Ebola outbreak in Western Africa. UNICEF is fully aware of the fact that religious communities are uniquely positioned to reach the most vulnerable children and families. Those communities that very often governments and international organizations have more difficulties in reaching effectively. Religious actors are also grounded in philosophical frameworks that shape their community service into a long-term commitment to peace, justice, and social equality. For example, in humanitarian settings, many religious institutions and faith-based NGOs are have a comparative advantage. First of all, they have established a relationship of trust and familiarity with the local communities. They are there in the settings of humanitarian emergencies way before the crisis emerges. When the crisis emerges, they are very often first responders. They are key providers of assistance to the population in need. And most importantly, they are bound to be there in the long term, way after international organizations leave the country once the crisis is not anymore in the front page of newspapers. But aside from the potential benefits that these actors can bring to a partnership, they are also able to provide their beliefs and their practices are also able to provide a lot of psychological, spiritual, and emotional support to people in distress in key moments of their lives. About a year ago, UNICEF conducted a global mapping of its engagement with religious organizations. We wanted to understand how much we actually do work with them in the field where the real action takes place. And the results were very, very interesting. They speak to the importance of religious actors as partners for UNICEF. We found out that over two-thirds of our participating country offices were partnering with religious actors in a way or another. And this speaks to the importance of this of these kinds of partnerships. We found out that two-thirds of our country offices engage with three or more different kinds of religious actors. By that I mean they could be religious institutions, churches, mosques, they could be faith-based organizations like NGOs, but faith-based. They could be community-based organizations, women's groups, youth groups, all this different range. And the fact that we engage with all of them at the same time with different strategies speaks also to the to the variety of faith actors that are active on the field. And the fact that over half of our country offices finally were engaged with religious actors in three or more of our outcome areas, by outcome areas of UNICEF, I mean HIV/AIDS rather than protection, rather than education, all the different aspects of children's rights that we engage with. So the fact that over half of our country offices engaged with religious actors in three or more of these areas at the same time speaks also, I believe, to the range of capabilities of faith organizations as partners. Last September, UNICEF signed a letter of collaboration with the World Council of Churches, and Klaus is also going to speak about that. But I cannot not mention this, because as the mapping shows, okay, this is only one of the many partnerships that UNICEF has with faith communities, but at the same time, it's a very important one. It's a very special one, and this for two reasons. First of all, because of the broad reach of the World Council of Churches. The World Council of Churches has 345 member churches, reaching over half a billion Christians in 140 countries. So, of course, that's a key partner to us. But at the same time, this partnership is special also for a specific project that I believe is very innovative and has a lot of potential. Since last summer, we brought together a group of experts from composed by key representatives of member churches, representatives from UNICEF, and from other child-focused NGOs. And this group of experts has been working to develop a set of principles and tools for child-friendly churches. What are these principles? They outline concrete actions that each church can take to respect and to promote the respect of children's rights in two areas. First of all, by addressing what they can do in their own domain, so inside your own church, in your health institution, in your school, what they can do to make sure that children are protected, that children participate, and so on and so forth. At the same time, these principles also address concrete steps that churches can take to advocate for children's rights outside their own domain. So what I mean is in the broader community, with their congregations, with the families that have so much trust in them. While UNICEF has a long experience in working for the promotion of children's rights, actors like the World Council of Churches, partners like the World Council of Churches, have often proven to be key to bringing about, a world fit for children. And this is because they have a strong theological background that is grounded in children's rights, and at the same time, the World Council of Churches, for example, the Secretariat, has a strong appeal on the member churches in encouraging them to promote children's rights. So I know that the Religion Communicators Council is an association of communicators who work with a diverse group of faith-based organizations in the area of communication, of public relations and marketing. So I imagine that on one hand, maybe you are interested in hearing why UNICEF believes in partnerships with faith actors. But at the same time, probably you're wondering, yes, all this is great, but then what? What does it really mean for me as a communicator, and what role can I play? I think that whether you are aware of it or not, and whether you are already using this potential to its full advantage or not, you as communicators have a key role to play in society. Unfortunately, in the last decades, we had countless examples of the destructive potential of media when it is used to exacerbate social tension or to reinforce what are dangerous stereotypes. One of the darkest examples of this was the role that a radio station called Radio Télévision Libre de Mille Collines played in inciting genocide in Rwanda. The radio told people to go to work, and everyone knew that meant get your machete and kill Tutsis, said a genocide survivor. And unfortunately, this is not only history. Today in Europe, demagogues are exploiting the current migrant crisis to foster bigotry and to their own political and personal advantage. And once again, media are not hesitating to pick up the stories and amplifying them to the benefit of their own economic profit. But just as we have countless examples of the destructive role that media and communication can play, we today, more than ever, we are aware of the key role that communicators can play in inspiring change in society. And I would like now for us to see a short excerpt from a TED Talk by the writer Chimamanda Adichie. It is called The Danger of a Single Story.
I come from a conventional middle-class Nigerian family. My father was a professor. My mother was an administrator. And so we had, out of the dorm, living domestic help who would often come from nearby rural villages. So the year I turned 8, we got a new house boy. His name was Fide. The only thing my mother told us about him was that his family was very poor. My mother sent yams and rice and our old clothes to his family. And when I didn't finish my dinner, my mother would say, "Finish your food. Don't you know people like Fide's family have nothing?" So I felt enormous pity for Fide's family. Then one Saturday, we went to his village to visit. And his mother showed us a beautifully patterned basket made of dyed raffia that his brother had made. I was startled. It had not occurred to me that anybody in his family could actually make something. All I had heard about them was how poor they were, so that it had become impossible for me to see them as anything else but poor. Their poverty was my single story of them. Years later, I thought about this when I left Nigeria to go to university in the United States. I was 19. My American roommate was shocked by me. She asked where I had learned to speak English so well, and was confused when I said that Nigeria happened to have English as its official language. She asked if she could listen to what she called my tribal music, and was consequently very disappointed when I produced my tape of Mariah Carey. She assumed that I did not know how to use a stove. What struck me was this: she had felt sorry for me even before she saw me. Her default position toward me as an African was a kind of patronizing, well-meaning pity. My roommate had a single story of Africa, a single story of catastrophe. In this single story, there was no possibility of Africans being similar to her in any way, no possibility of feelings more complex than pity, no possibility of a connection as human equals. So that is how to create a single story. Show a people as one thing, as only one thing, over and over again, and that is what they become. It is impossible to talk about the single story without talking about power. There is a word, an Igbo word, that I think about whenever I think about the power structures of the world, and it is nkani. It's a noun that loosely translates to be greater than another. Like our economic and political worlds, stories too are defined by the principle of nkani. How they are told, who tells them, when they are told, how many stories are told, are really dependent on power. Power is the ability not just to tell the story of another person, but to make it the definitive story of that person. The Palestinian poet Mourid Barghouti writes that if you want to dispossess a people, the simplest way to do it is to tell their story and to start with secondly. Start the story with the arrows of the Native Americans and not with the arrival of the British, and you have an entirely different story. Start the story with the failure of the African state and not with the colonial creation of the African state, and you have an entirely different story.
This video goes on way longer than the time I was allowed today, but I think it gives a very clear idea of what Chimamanda Adichie means by the danger of a single story. So back to your role now, the role you can play. I believe that by refusing to perpetrate single stories, you can help develop a space for a plurality of voice and narratives. By ensuring that marginalized groups and vulnerable groups are given visibility and voice, you can help promote the principles of inclusion, self-determination, and participation. By promoting the active and meaningful participation of women and children, you can help them being perceived and be the agents of change that they are, or that they can be. And finally, by disseminating information about the many, many initiatives that are happening on the ground, like the partnership with the between UNICEF and the World Council of Churches, you can help people being aware of what is going on and understand how they can help, how they can contribute to make this world a better place. Incredible synergies can be created when people learn that the community center next block, it's collecting old clothes and recycling them, or that the church they attend is collecting money or sending volunteers to help people on the other side of the world, or that finally at the United Nations, a very, very transformative and ambitious agenda like the Sustainable Development Goals, Agenda 2030, has just been adopted with the participation, unprecedented participation from all sectors of civil society. The calls, many calls and emails that my colleagues at the World Council of Churches in Geneva receive every day from member churches who have heard about a project with UNICEF on children's rights through their website, through their newsletter, or in all other means that Klaus will tell you about. This is a testament of the virtuous circle that can be created when this kind of information is made available.
So, thank you, Katerina. So hold on to your questions, and we'll hear next from Dr. Olusimbo Ige. Oh, Klaus, I'm sorry. Well, we won't hear from Olusimbo. We'll hear from Klaus Gruwe.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here. It's a pleasure and an honor to have the opportunity to say a few words about the World Council of Churches and how we operate in terms of communications. As Katerina already touched upon, we are quite a big organization with 345 member churches in 110 countries. We represent 500 million Christians, and from various churches. So this is, of course, a very important and large organization, but perhaps not so well known. Particularly not among the public, I would say. UNICEF is much more of a household name than the WCC. And there is, of course, an explanation to that. We are not seeking to build a brand in the same way. I mean, we are a member organization. The important focus in our organization, is the member churches in all these countries. So our job is to support the member churches, not to be visible as such. That is the role of the member churches. Now, I come from the Church of Sweden, and we are one of the largest Protestant churches in the world, with 7 million members in Sweden. That is all. That is around 70% of the population, almost, in Sweden. And of course, in Sweden, no one knows about the World Council of Churches, but everyone knows about the Church of Sweden. So, and it is the Church of Sweden who should be visible, of course. So that is important to understand. We are, as I said, a fellowship of churches, and this is all available on our website, formulated in this way. And of course, we have a mission, and we have a role to play. And of course, that is everything is grounded in our faith. And that is something that is always there, because otherwise we wouldn't. That's the core of our identity. Yes. And if you're a member of the Church of Sweden, there are of course certain expectations and privileges, and. Advantages of being a member of the World Council of Churches, you will be a member of one big Christian family, one big fellowship. And that gives us, of course, strength as an organization to be one big family. To engage in Christian service by serving human need, breaking down barriers between people, seeking justice and peace, and upholding the integrity of the creation, and to foster renewal in unity, worship, mission, and service. So I think you're all familiar with this. I don't have to go into more detail here. That is of course, the core of the organization. This is a picture taken in September last year when our General Secretary, Mr. Olav Fiksetveit, Dr. Olav Fiksetveit, who's a Norwegian, signed the agreement with the UNICEF, here represented by Liza Berry, the director of UNICEF, one of the directors of UNICEF. Now I'll go into the value of the partnership, which is really, from a communications perspective, very interesting and very important. Now, as I said, we are not a household name as such, but UNICEF is a household name more. And we do operate in different ways. I mean, the UNICEF, they are the experts on child rights, definitely. It's a well-known organization for that. But the churches around the world, as Katarina also mentioned, in rural areas, we play a very important role, because the church is often at the center of the community in rural areas. And the church leaders play a very important role in rural areas in many countries. So if you want to connect with people in rural areas, the church is an important player. And that is, of course, very beneficial for a partnership like this. And we can provide channels to reach out to the people and the living in rural areas, which we already have done in various ways. For instance, in Indonesia, which is one of the pilot countries of this partnership, where material produced by the UNICEF reaches out to small communities in rural areas through the local churches. So that is, of course, a very, very important aspect of this. No, not yet. Also, we have an extensive global network, being present in 110 countries, and with 345 member churches, we have an enormous network, also in rural areas. The branding aspect of this is, as I mentioned earlier, the strength of the UNICEF brand which is a respected and very strong brand and connected very closely with child rights. We share the same concerns, of course, the well-being of children. And we also have a shared mission to improve the well-being of children. And as part of this partnership is all about violence against children, preventing violence against children, which unfortunately is a common problem in many countries. And here we can join forces preventing violence against children, which is an important task. We are actually, we often talk about a pilgrimage of justice and peace. That is one of our main headlines at the moment, since our last General Assembly in the World Council of Churches. So we are actually joining forces here in a pilgrimage of justice and peace with and for children. And we can also join forces in mutual capacity building, training trainers, both in rural areas and in more populated areas, where we can help each other with material and with training of trainers. To sum it up, this partnership is all about a better life for children throughout the world. And there, of course, communication plays a very critical role in order to do so. Yes. Here is a picture taken in Jakarta in May last year at the Christian Christian Conference of Asia at their General Assembly, and here we have representatives from the World Council of Churches. The UNICEF in the middle, the UNICEF representative in Indonesia, Ms. Lauren Rumble, and our Indonesian representative in Geneva, to the right. And you can read more about this partnership at our homepage, where we have a special page which is called WCC Child Right Engagement. Here you can read everything. We publish on a regular basis narratives from around the world about this issue. We publish documents from conferences. We publish stories from a seminar that we had in November on this issue together with UNICEF. So we publish regularly interesting material relating to this subject and to the partnership. Our main messages in terms of communications are these. These are all part, of course, of a communications plan. And as communicators, you, of course, know the importance of a communications plan. Right? You all have those, don't you? Then, of course, it's a question if everyone adheres to the plan. But that can be a challenge sometimes. Anyway, our main messages summed up are that the fundamentalism of children's rights and well-being, and also to create awareness about the common problem that this is, and that it is unacceptable. This is often a dormant and condoned reality in many cultures. There are different traditions in different countries, and it takes time, of course, to change awareness and to change the attitude towards this problem and create awareness. But it is important to point out that violence against children is preventable, but it takes time, and it requires professional communications to do so. So joint efforts on a global scale here are crucial, and this is what this partnership also is all about. So we can, together, we can make a difference for children throughout the world. That is what we have set out to do now. We do have a few examples but they are not ready for presentation yet. But we are working, the countries that we currently are working intensively right now is Indonesia and Nigeria, and also India, actually, where we have a few examples of more concrete examples, which you will be able to read more about later on our webpage. Lastly, this partnership also covers the aspect of climate change, where children are the most vulnerable, of course, to climate change. So that is an important aspect of this partnership as well, where we also have joined forces. That, in short, is the partnership from a WCC perspective. And should we take questions later on? Or okay, thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Klaus. So now we will have Dr. Olusin Boigbe.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Are you still awake? Did you have some coffee? Good. My task is to give you the perspective from the faith-based nonprofit world. So Katerina has spoken to you from the United Nations perspective. We've heard from World Council of Churches. I work for Global Ministries of the United Methodist Church. And the United Methodist Church is 12 million members strong, with churches in over 100 countries. And it's called United Methodist Church because there is a common meeting point for all of these churches, even though they're autonomous to one level or the other. And Global Ministries is the agency of the United Methodist Church that is tasked with the responsibility of connecting the church and mission. And I am the director of Global Health of Global Ministries. And I'm going to try to see if this works, because I know technology is supposed to make our life easier. No? He doesn't? Okay, thank you. So, these are the questions that I was asked to talk to you about. What is the value of partnering with secular institutions such as the United Nations? What do the agreement consist of? How do these partnerships work? And what are the advantages? How do they advance the goals of better health or protection? And what motivated our organization to sign on to this agreement? And like I said, I'm talking to you from the United Methodist perspective. And I'm going to start by asking you a question. How many people live in New York? How many people have been here before now, before this primary? How many people know it is possible to live in New York, one of the most diverse cities in the world, and not really explore all of the benefits of New York? I was having a conversation with my friends this morning, and we were saying how you can live right across the, you know, the street and have absolutely no knowledge of what is going on the other side of town. And that is how we are sometimes as faith-based organizations. We're so consumed in our work that we don't take the time to, you know, cross the street and see what's going on the other side. And this is what I'm going to be talking to you about, the advantage of taking a peek over the world and seeing what the possibilities are. As faith-based organizations, what is out there for us? What are the benefits of just exploring partnerships beyond our comfort zone, beyond other faith-based partners, beyond our churches? And that's what I'm going to be talking to you about. In 2002, the World Bank president, James Wolfensohn, said, "Half the work in education and health in sub-Saharan Africa is done by the church. But they don't talk to each other, and they don't talk to us." In 2015, The Lancet published a series about faith-based healthcare. And someone said, Jill Oliver, from South Africa, was writing with some other authors, and she said, "For better partnership to be achieved and for health systems to be strengthened by the alignment of faith-based health providers with national systems and priorities, improved information is needed at all levels. And that is what I'm going to be talking to you about. Do we talk to each other? Do we talk to others? And why should we? Next. The scope of global health challenges means that no single country or single agency can work to meet them. There's so many problems in the world with so many different causes, with so many layers of complication, that it is impossible for one single organization to have all the resources needed to tackle these problems. We need partnership. Some people's strengths are in national level, you know, working with the government. Some people have the expertise in mobilizing the community. Some people have the benefit of being able to communicate. We need to bring all of these resources together for greater impact. And by developing partnership and collaborating with other organizations with similar goals, we can broaden the scope of our effort. And that is basically the advantage of partnership. Two are better than one. It's the reason why we reach out for help, because the work is just too big. There's just too much to do that it's ridiculous for us to think that we can do it on our own. And besides that, as faith-based organizations, when we partner with the United Nations and other public sector organizations, we gain credibility and recognition. There's a tendency for those on the other side of the fence to say, you know, we don't know what they're doing, they're just fooling around. But when we work together, then we trust each other. Then I know what you're doing, and I know how you're doing it, and you gain credibility and recognition. And these were some of the reasons why we started exploring partnership beyond just the faith, our regular faith partners. Next. And this is one of the motivations. For us and the United Methodists, we consider ourselves to be a local and a global community of faith. As a United Methodist, this is the key message we put up and say, I am a part of a faith community that helps nurture my spiritual journey throughout all stages of life. But I am also a part of a worldwide community joined together in faith and service. So a recognition that we are part of this global community, anywhere where there is faith and service, we can work together. As long as we share that common motivation to provide service, to help, then there is possibility for partnership. Next. So in 2006, the United Methodists became a founding member of Nothing But Nets, a campaign of the United Nations Foundation. And I'll give you a little background for how this happened. The United Foundations, one of the organs of the United Nations, and really started to explore faith-based partnership. And they had reached out to faith-based organizations, United Methodists and Lutherans, and some other faith-based organizations, and said, there is this huge problem of malaria. Do you guys think that you can work with us on it? Can you do anything to support the effort? And we said, why not? And that the reason we said why not was the reason I had shown you before. We believe we're part of this global community of faith and service. So we said to United Nations, why not? What do you want us to do for you? And we said, we have this campaign, Nothing But Nets. How can you support us? And the United Methodists said, okay, well, let's see. We'll put you as one of the projects that we want the church members to support. And we have this instrument that we call the Advance within the United Methodists, where people can give to a cause. And people started giving to United Nations. And we raised $7 million to support Nothing But Nets. And because of that, in 2008, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation awarded an administrative grant of $5 million to launch the Imagine No Malaria campaign. So following that partnership in 2006 that started with us saying, you know what, we will contribute our resources to Nothing But Nets. In 2008, we decided to do more than Nets and say, we'll start our own Imagine No Malaria program of the United Methodist Church. But how do we get started? United Nations said, you know what, we'll support you. We'll help you start. And because of that relationship, we were linked to Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and we were giving a startup grant to help us launch the campaign. And so we started the campaign, and we pledged to raise $75 million to support malaria in 2008. And as a sign of our appreciation, we decided to split that money, 51% to go to Global Fund, which is the world, the global agency for malaria, HIV, and TB, and to give 49% to support the work of the United Methodist Church. And we raised, up to date, we have raised 68 million and some to support malaria. And this we have split 51-49. And we have given Global Fund over $20 million, the only faith-based organization that has not. Next. And this is the timeline. In 2006, we became founding member, and so on and so forth. Next. And this is what we have on our website, Global Partners Standing Together. We have the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Alliance of Malaria Prevention, the Global Fund, United Nations Foundation. And this is what we sell to the church and say we are part of this global community. We're working together to eliminate malaria. We're joining Global Fund, we're joining the United Nations, we're joining Bill and Melinda Gates, and we're doing our role as a church, supporting this global effort to eradicate malaria. Next. And this is us presenting a check to Global Fund, and the United Methodist Church is the first faith-based group to work in partnership with Global Fund. And the United Methodist, this is us presenting a check of $9.6 million to fight malaria in Africa to Global Fund, April 22, 2015. And what we say is Global Fund, through its scope and scale, saves thousands of lives every day. The United Methodists have joined this partnership by working with Global Fund on the ground and identifying nations where we can work together. And that's what Bishop Peterson of the United Methodists say. It is an important partnership. Working together will only lead to more. But besides that, we also bring value to that partnership, apart from what Global Fund can do for us. We say to Global Fund, we are the church. We are the one that can go to places where you cannot reach. Where the road ends, and that is a trip to Congo. And it's the picture is not very clear, but this is what we do as a church. Where the road ends, we continue going. We are the ones providing the personal relationship that better ensures effective distribution and use of bed nets and prevention drugs. When you hand over the nets to someone, you need trust to believe that this is actually good for you. We have the relationship with the people on the ground to convince them that this is actually good for you. We are the ones providing rural clinics, traditional bath attendants, volunteers to educate people, and providing clean water. We say in the United Methodist, every United Methodist church has a well or water for the community. We are the ones with trusted relationship to convince people to change the behavior. That's what we do as a church. We encourage people to change for the better. So who else can take this message to the people and say, you know what, you need to sleep under a net? It's not enough for Global Fund to give you a net. When the church supports that message by saying, this net that you've been given is very important, sleep under it, then the message is reinforced and people trust us and we'll do it. Next. And like I said before, this partnership gives recognition to the efforts of the church. Imagine No Malaria receives CARE 2 Innovator Award. This was an award that was given to the United Methodist Church Imagine No Malaria program, March 5, 2015. We were selected to receive this award as an honor given to nonprofit causes that make a difference. Next. This is also another award, and that is me, believe me or not. That's me receiving the award. You have to take my word for it. Imagine No Malaria recognized as a superhero at global meeting. And this is what at the Alliance of Malaria Prevention meeting in Geneva in 2015. Imagine No Malaria received a superhero award from the Rotarians Action Group on Malaria. The award was given during the meeting as recognition for our grassroots efforts in reaching rural and hard-to-reach areas in prevention efforts. That work that we were doing in prevention and mobilizing the community became recognized because of this partnership. I know that there are many other faith-based organizations doing wonderful work, but who knows it? Who's telling the story? We don't talk to each other, we don't talk to others. But because of this partnership, there is that recognition of the role of the church in supporting global efforts. United Methodist is a valued partner because of our long history of health ministry and our existing hospitals and clinics that provide healthcare in places where no one else does to people who otherwise will not be reached. That is the value we bring to that partnership. Next. Through partnership, we have made extraordinary progress. I said to you at the beginning, it increases impact. It increases the scope of our effort. And this is an example. In 2007, the World Health Organization estimated that more than 1 million malaria-related fatalities were occurring. In 2015, that number was reduced to 48,000. That's over a 50% decrease in mortality in malaria.
In 2007, over 1 million children were dying from malaria annually. That has dropped to just over 400,000 in 2015. That's more than 50% reduction in malaria mortality. That is not the work of one agency. It's a work of so many people working together in partnership. And we are very proud to say we are part of that partnership. And thanks to the combined efforts of the United Methodist Church and our partners, we're beating malaria. We can share that story. We can say we're a part of this success story because we are a part of it. Next. Can you go back? And this is our contribution to these numbers. 4.6 million lives impacted through our direct efforts through the United Methodist Church. Over 2.3 million nets that we have distributed since 2010 when we launched the campaign. We're working in over 16 countries in Africa. We've reached 91% of our $75 million fundraising target. And these are things that we can share with the world and say this is how we're contributing to this global success story. Next. And because of our success with Imagine No Malaria, the United Methodist Church has been invited to explore partnership far greater in scope and capacity than ever before. Recognition. Then you become a part of the dialogue. We want to be recognized. We want to have a voice in these decisions that are made. We want to contribute our resources to these things that will impact health and impact well-being of mothers and children. But now we're being invited to that dialogue because of the relationship that we have had, because people now know we have credibility with United Nations. And our latest partnership is Every Woman, Every Child, with whom we will work to improve the health of women, children, and adolescents. And this is the commitment we made to Every Woman, Every Child. Our pledge is to reach 1 million children by 2020. And this is a global health effort. The Every Woman, Every Child is a global... Next slide. Is the global strategy for women, children, and adolescent health, 2016 to 2030. And the goal, overall goal of Every Woman, Every Child, is to reach 15 million children. And we are saying as a church, we are committing to reaching 1 million of those children with life-saving intervention. This is another opportunity for us to partner to change the world. Next. And this is United Nations Every Woman, Every Child webpage. And this is Global Ministries. General Brother of Global Ministries has committed to reach 1 million children with life-saving interventions between 2016 and 2020 as part of our contribution to this global effort. Next. I go back to where I started. In 2002, the World Bank president said half the work in education and health in sub-Saharan Africa is being done by the church. But they don't talk to us and they don't talk to each other. But that is no longer true. This is the story we're sharing with you. We're making an effort to talk to each other and to talk to others beyond the church. And this is where we're at. For better partnership to be achieved and for health systems to be strengthened, the alignment of faith-based health providers with national systems and international organizations and the United Nations, improved information is needed at all levels. We need to communicate with others. We need to let the church know the value of this partnership. We need to sit at the table and be a part of this conversation in changing the world and in changing the health of children and health generally all over the world. Thank you very much.
So thank you to our panelists for their very thoughtful input this morning. Now, if you have questions or comments about the presentations or for any of the particular speakers, Linda has a microphone. Linda?
My question was for the United Methodist Woman. As a result of the partnership with the Global Fund, have you, and the raising of the visibility of the United Methodist Church in global work, have you been able to make other partnerships and things around some other of the work of the United Methodist Church that's grown out of your work with the Global Fund?
Yes. In addition to giving funding to Global Fund, in sub-Saharan Africa, we have what we call the health boards, which are like the bodies of the United Methodist Church implementing health programs in the community. They have also benefited by receiving grants from Global Fund to implement malaria control programs in Africa. So that's one advantage we're giving to Global Fund, but Global Fund is also granting to the smaller faith-based organizations that are United Methodist based, affiliated. In addition to that, we're part of the conversation on HIV. So we have the United Methodist Global AIDS Fund, which has been working closely with Global Fund and to, again, expand the reach of our projects. And we have a United Nations Office of Global Ministries, where we're also part of the conversation around children's rights. In addition to that, that's the United Methodist Women is also part of that conversation. And in addition to that, we have the United Nations Foundation and the UNICEF inviting us to conversation around the Sustainable Development Goals and what we can do as a church to help increase awareness and increase mobilized support for the Sustainable Development Goals. So we are constantly being invited to the conversation where opportunities for funding is shared with us, and our stories of impact includes us. So those are some of the other areas in which this partnership has been beneficial.
Thanks. This has been very informative. I'm Dave Colton. One of the kind of the key messages that I keep waiting to hear, and I keep missing it, is the question around, I think, a very important message, which is safe homes equal safe children. You know, loving homes equal loving children. It seems to me that the family is always being bypassed in any discussion. We go directly from whether it's people of faith to the children, whether we talk about the UN, it's to the children, whether we talk about women. And yet when we look at it, you know, what is the source of the strongest children? Strong families. What are the source of the weakest children? Weak families. What can we do as religious communicators to really bring home that focus on family and the importance of creating that safe environment, loving environment, faith-filled environment for children to prosper? Thank you.
I can try to answer that. The family is, as you say, very important in order to prevent, for instance, violence against children. And therefore also it is a main target group for our communication efforts in rural, in everywhere, especially in rural areas, because the family is the key. I would say the school, the teachers, and the family, parents of the children, they are key target groups to reach out to, in order to build awareness and create change along the way. So I'm sorry if we perhaps missed out on that, but they are definitely a priority.
Just to add one thing. Actually, when I was mentioning at the beginning what are the points in common between the United Nations and UNICEF, so a child rights perspective, and faith organizations. One of them is the belief in the centrality of the family as the best place where to raise a child. We apply that in our child protection interventions, for example, for example, trying to avoid institutionalization of children as much as possible and really working with governments, with a social welfare system to have alternatives such as foster care or care by the extended family, whatever, whenever that is possible. So that's one point. And in relation to the partnership with the World Council of Churches, as Klaus was saying, the family actually is incredibly important. In the document itself that we drafted about the principles for child-friendly churches, it's specifically its role is specifically recognized, and churches are asked to, of course, first of all, promote and protect children's rights, do all that is in their power to promote and protect children's rights in their own domain, so inside their own church, make sure, just to name one thing, to make sure that children are protected and they're not subject to any violence or abuse, or that when it happens, they know who to, there is someone who they can speak with and they can identify the problem and address it in a fast and effective manner. But that is only the first step. A broader approach is what we're trying to have with bringing families on board. So abuses against children and violence against children happen, of course, in churches, unfortunately. But we know that it happens very often in the families. So having a safe, trying to create a safe space inside the church where this, first of all, where these conversations can happen, where pastors can speak about what is going on behind closed doors. And so first of all, addressing the issue as uncomfortable as it is, and again, creating safe spaces where children can tell what is going on in their homes, and where parents can also be brought in the conversation and be made aware of what they can do and of the negative effects of some social norms and cultural traditions that maybe are perceived to be as perfectly normal in a society, and maybe it's what the way they were brought up as well. So they might believe that it's normal as it was done to me. That's how I have to behave with my children as well. I believe that creating this safe space for this sort of dialogues to happen is one important first step.
Thank you. So this is kind of a general question for all of you. Are there general practices or is there a framework in place on the part of any of your organizations to sort of guide work between churches and non-Christian local religious groups? Because it's something that can be very sensitive interactions right in those... There, you know, as a Catholic, I think we're very aware of charges of proselytizing and it being an exchange. So can you speak a little bit to whether that's something that, you know, is talked about or there are frameworks or something? Thank you.
I'll just share the experience of the United Methodist Church. Apart from the global health work, we have UMCOR, which is the United Methodist Committee on Relief, that is tasked with our humanitarian response. And even though we're faith-based, we're bound by the SPHERE standards, which is the humanitarian guidelines. In an emergency situation, we respond to everyone, regardless of their faith, regardless of their color, regardless of their age. Because that is the human right-based approach. So even though we're a church and we're not shy to say that we're the church and that our motivation for doing this is based on our theology, in responding to needs, we have no discrimination based on religious affiliation. So, and we try to keep our evangelization and encouraging people to join the faith separate from our humanitarian response. And the same thing obtains in health when there is a mission hospital. We serve everyone. We just don't serve members of the church or members of our denomination. We provide service across board to whoever needs it, wherever they need it.
Hi, I'm Ray Grant. I work with United Methodist Women. I had a question, a general question about rights of children. In addition to violence against children, what are other specific rights are you working for the children, like fresh water, whatever? I'm just wondering what the range is, and how you approach the families besides, you know, working with cultural differences and different value systems. Maybe they, you know, smack their kids or not. So what are the rights of children that you're working for besides domestic violence against them?
Do you mean specifically in this partnership with the World Council of Churches or in general?
Relating more to what you were talking about with UNICEF.
Okay. So UNICEF works on all rights of children. We are guided by the Convention on the Rights of the Child that lists all rights of children. This goes from protection to the right to life, of course, so health, education, non-discrimination, etc., etc. So this encompasses really a lot of aspects. Wash, water and sanitation, immunization, all kinds of health services, education, as I was saying, and education not only, of course, in the first years of childhood, but throughout. The right to participation, so that is for all children, of course, but of course it becomes more and more important as the child grows up. The right to early childhood development in general, again, it's very much linked to health. Non-discrimination against children with disabilities. That's all I can think of right now, but I'm sure I'm missing some of them. So this is the mandate of UNICEF. We work all over the world, mainly with governments. That means that we are, being a United Nations agency, what we do is we enter in a country, we have upon the request of a government, we have an agreement with the government. We work with them to develop a plan with them and actually with a lot of civil society partners and with all other UN agencies. We work to develop a multi-year plan in which we say, according to the specific mandate of each UN agency, so in our case for children, okay, these are our targets. So for immunization, we are going to work hand in hand with the Ministry of Health to provide that immunization. That then, of course, that's where civil society comes into play, because as Simbo was saying, okay, that's definitely our strength, because we have a role to play with a government, and that's we have credibility, we have sort of means that other organizations don't have. But on the other hand, once we decide, okay, all this is all great, we're going to go there and immunize those kids, guess what? How exactly? We don't have the means or the credibility or that sort of trust relationship that Simbo was referring to. So that's where civil society organizations come into play and faith organizations come into play. For the partnership with the World Council of Churches, the idea in developing the principles for child-friendly churches was, in theory, to take the Convention on the Rights of the Child and say, how does that apply to churches? Then in practice, since it needs to be really a joint effort and a continuous process that is always under development, we needed to start from something, right? It might be a little overwhelming to just take a whole convention and try to apply to churches, and there were a lot of concerns about that. So we started by with the group that I referred to, composed mainly by key members of member churches. We started by those principles, so read those rites that they deemed more fit in this moment to start with. So this is child protection. And under child protection, of course, there is violence, there is child protection in emergencies. So again, the role that, that faith actors can play in humanitarian settings. There is birth registration, for example, that all goes are different aspects of child protection. The right to participation. Then the role that churches can play in raising awareness about children's rights in general, and then climate, the right to climate. Actually, that's something that I didn't mention in my first list. It's something that is actually a little bit recent for UNICEF as an area of engagement. It's coming up more and more, the evidence of how of the negative impact of climate change on children, how it affects really a lot of children's rights in a negative way is coming up more and more, and so it's an important area of engagement for UNICEF now.
Thank you. I'm from Arigato International. Thank you, first of all, for the excellent presentations. It's really informative. I think my question is more directed to Dr. Ige. I'm wondering about specific strategies that your organization use that have worked to gain sort of co-ownership or maybe sense of involvement of your individual members of your church that are that may not be aware so much about the malaria issues. What kind of communications or other engagement strategies do you use so that I think your notion about very impressive amount of funding that was being provided from your organization, I'm assuming that part of it comes from individual members and donors from your communities and church members. So my question is, how do you engage them and keep them engaged so that they want to keep giving or they feel that I am contributing to this end to malaria?
One of the lessons we have learned is that helping people to see the impact of the challenges on the people they know and they're connected with. Our engagement with malaria started because one of our bishops lost his wife to malaria. And he was able to share that story at General Conference, which is where all the United Methodist representatives come together every 4 years. This is a disease that is totally preventable. This is a disease that can be cured with $1 to $2 worth of medication in 3 days. And yet people die from it. And he's saying that my wife has just died from malaria. And there were many people in the audience who could say we've lost a member of our family to malaria. So that was a powerful moment of connection and say this is not just out there, we're not connected to it. And as members of the same church, saying we're united, it was very easy to say if we have other churches all over the world suffering and bearing this same burden, it is our Christian responsibility to support the effort. And the interesting story about for us about the Imagine Malaria and getting the church engagement is that we gave people the opportunity. There was a lot of creativity in each individual church deciding on how they wanted to participate. And there are all kinds of stories of people doing races and all kinds of things to raise awareness in their local church and join the effort. And right now, I think the average single contribution is about $80, and the average pledge is about $800, $700. So it's not just one individual giving $20 million, or it's everyone participating in whatever little way they can. And so it's a powerful story of we're all doing something about this, no matter how little, it makes a difference. So we've had remarkable engagement because we've been able to share that connection. The churches in Africa come and share their stories. The churches in Europe and others have a meeting forum where they can share these ideas. And I think that's been our strength.
Hi, I'm Dina Zingaro from CBS News. I was just curious if how your teams deal with pushback in local communities, perhaps violent in nature, if your teams have, you know, security and, you know, what sort of dangerous environments, if any, they work in?
Difficult question. Of course, these situations can occur. But I can only say that in a faith-based organization, which the churches belong to, it is, of course, unacceptable. I'm quite confident that it is being dealt with properly, but we are not able to monitor every corner of the world. So, creating awareness and running campaigns, talking to children's parents, teachers, working on government levels, on national levels, I think is will help anyway. And I also think the media plays a very important role here, because if something hits the news, whether negative or positive, it will have an enormous impact. And one way or the other, it will help communities to deal with the problem, if there is a problem, as you describe. But it will also help raise awareness to the question of, for instance, violence against children. So the media is also one of our target groups for the communications. It is, of course, important that what you describe also is being dealt with. I guess that's what I can say right now. But I would underline the importance of the media, both in terms of positive and negative news. Media plays an important role.
I just wanted to clarify, when you say violence, are you talking about the violence against children or violence in the areas where we operate? Violence in the areas where we operate? Okay. Like I shared before, one advantage that faith-based organizations have is that they are connected to the grassroots. So if there are threats, if there are dangers, they are members of the community, they know. They know where to go. They know who to go to. One thing that we have learned, I mean, all our programs are implemented by local people. And if we have to go to project site, for instance, that's outside people, we let the local people lead and guide what is safe and what is culturally acceptable and who are the people you need to talk to who can offer protection to these services. And I think we've enjoyed the trust and the support of the community, again, because of the faith-based connection. People are able to... I'll give the example of Ebola, for instance, where in a place like Liberia, when the government workers came, they were attacked by the community because they felt that they were the ones bringing Ebola. And they said, oh, anywhere these people go, 2 days, 3 days after, then there's an outbreak. So they are the ones, you know, spreading this Ebola. But getting the bishop to talk on the radio and say, these are the experiences, this is what we're doing, and this is why we're doing it, created free passage for the church. And there was greater trust in the message coming from the church than in coming from the government. You know, so we have enjoyed that level of interaction with the community. But there are also places where there are religious conflict, where bringing a message as a Christian organization may be considered a threat, you know, to the stability of the organization. But also saying this is health, this is not just about us trying to expand the influence of our church, this is about responding to people who need help. And if we have the resources to help and support you, then we've never had any experience of pushback at the community level, mainly because we're going through the channels that are trusted and we let the local people lead the way and guide what will be the best kind of engagement in each situation.
Just Katarina
Just add one thing. I think what you just the example that Simpo just gave in the Ebola outbreak was a key example of how religious communities were able to actually ease those tensions that were raising, of course, as a result of people are dying, parts of my families are dying, I am scared. Each time those people all dressed up from the government that I don't trust come here, something bad happens. So that's a very human instinct to be afraid of and suspicious. That's a great example of how actually the message being passed by religious leaders made it so that a trust relationship was been built, and so violence was as much as possible avoided. Another example that comes to my mind is what is called monitoring and reporting mechanism. MRM, for example, is something that UNICEF developed in some countries where we work, where, for example, the idea is to bring build a network of at the community level, so that basically the information can be passed and can reach the UN, the government, whoever is responsible. And for the information, I mean information about human rights violations. So in some conflict settings, if children are recruited in armed forces, for example, from the UNICEF perspective, but also from a broader perspective, when social tensions are increasing and there is a feeling that something is exploding, that something is about to explode. So in that case, for example, having a local network of communities, being churches and mosques, of course, very often are key players in that, but not only, all kinds of already existing community networks that are structured in a way for which when there is something happening, either a violation that has already happened or something that you have the feeling is happening, you know where to go to, who to tell it to, who goes to another person, who goes to another person, who goes to the authority or the UN, hopefully. So that's another example of course, it doesn't address all kinds of violence, but sometimes it can play a role in further violence to exacerbate and explode.
Catherine Marshall, I really appreciated these presentations. Very professional, very informative, and I think really adding to the stock. And also they highlight the importance of the positive stories, which are far too little known and in the communication. I did think it was interesting, though, to highlight at least four sort of communications challenges that, at the moment as an academic, I can, or working on the bridges, I think are worth highlighting. First of all, on the family issue, there are a lot of reasons why people don't talk about family as much as they're scared of the issue, because of the enormous divisions within religious communities that turn around what is a family. And I think a lot of people, myself included, resent that because we all have families. Families are obviously critical. And the fact that it becomes almost a taboo issue because of the furious debates around what is a family and the nature of the family is something that I think communicators should address. A second, I mean, clearly, the issue of proselytizing comes up. We've done in our research work in every world region, and I assure you, every single world region, the issue of proselytizing comes up. It's one of the major images that people in the secular world have of religious groups, and it calls into question the motivation, and it needs to be discussed. And the complex ways that it's related to religious freedom needs to be discussed. Because proselytism, when it's linked to development or humanitarian aid, is different from the freedom of religion issues. And there's far too little discussion of what that involves. I mean, the third is that there are backlashes against child rights and human rights that, again, are a major story that we need to deal with. just as a specific example, on the children's right issue, the question of parents' authority and teachers' authority is something that people are really pushing back on and that needs to be discussed. And just as one final issue that, again, I think is a real communication challenge, every time I see that Wolfensohn quote, it drives me crazy because I was probably responsible for it. And it's completely wrong. We know that. We've known that for at least 10 to 12 years, that the figure of half of education and health in Africa provided by religious organizations is wrong. We don't know what it is, but we know that it's far less. And the fact that we know so little is the problem, and that it is so different in different countries. But I think these are, I mean, the point is that just in this discussion, enormous and fascinating issues of communication come up that we could do very well to push and to pursue.
Want to thank our entire panel, please.